Hey, gang. It's your old pal, Andrea. I'm joining you here at the top of this late episode to let you know that if it were next week, this episode would technically not be late because we're going to be shifting our release schedule a little bit. And from now on, at least until Yellow Jackets comes back, Wednesday is going to be our official release day. And so we'll come at you right in the middle of the week when you need us most, I'll bet. And that'll give you a little more time to watch whatever we're watching. Thank you for your patience, and hopefully now moving forward, you'll get us right in your feed when you're supposed to, which will now be Wednesday mornings. Enjoy this episode. Love you, mean it.
You're listening to The Watchers, a show where two women from opposite ends of New Jersey watch television about their youth and wonder how they survived. I'm Jody.
I'm Andrea.
We watched the pilot of Six Feet Under.
We did. A show that I can't believe I've never watched before.
I don't know
how it happened.
I think it's time frame mainly. Just like, I don't know, maybe not, but this show,
It's 2001 to 2005, so I would have been, and I had friends who were obsessed with it.
Yeah.
So I would have been, 15 to 19? So maybe a little young, but...
Yeah. I was, mid to late 20s mm-hmm. when this show was on, and it was just absolutely everything. I was obsessed with the show.
You know what it is? I think for me, I'm kind of interested to see if this ends up being true, and I've just never realized it until right now, is there are two things going on. When I was 16 to 19 is when I worked at the movie theater, and I was watching movies constantly. If I wasn't on the clock at work, I was there watching something.
Yeah.
And also the only other thing I was doing was going to shows. I was really into the local music scene and also traveling around for bigger bands and stuff at the time. So it's possible I just didn't have as much time for TV until.
Well, and conversely from that, from 2001 to 2005 was the bulk of my professional life in New York City when I was a 9-to-5 office.
And then just going home
advertising
and
drone.
Tune in, tune out, right?
Yeah.
Tune in, drop out.
Drop out. Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah. No, because I would So I started working in the city in 99 and I left in the end of 2005. And so this spanned the biggest chunk of my life as an office person.
Right.
And so the Sunday night appointment television of it all was I was perfectly primed for that because I was working Monday through Friday, 9-to-5. You know, this was a thing that HBO had a hold on for a really long time, right? So Sopranos came out, 2000?
99,
okay. Yeah, and so...
So there was a time
this was,
not...
What's that?
We're not on a delay. I just fully interrupted you. I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay.
I'm just realizing, there is a time where people were watching Sopranos and Six Feet Under the same...
Yeah.
I just can imagine that was a beautiful...
It was a beautiful time.
Time
yes.
for some people.
Yeah. In New Jersey and California were Sunday nights on HBO.
Yeah. Well, and as I said to you in a text, some of this show is Jersey coded.
Agreed. Well, so I know we usually save the Jersey connection for the end, but I did find something that relates to this conversation that I might as well just bring up right now.
Okay.
So we talked about the sort of season two of Friday Night Lights of it all, the off the rail season of a show, and how season two of Yellow Jackets kind of feels like it might have been that. For Six Feet Under, that was season four.
Okay.
Things got a little chaotic and very dramatic.
I started to say I can't wait, which I guess tells you how I feel about the show, that I'm imagining being there for season four at some point in my life.
It's it's not wildly different. It's just amped up to 10.
Gotcha.
And there's an episode where David is fucking carjacked, abused, has this horrible, horrible experience. And it was really, really divisive. People kind of hated it because it was it was kind of torture porn for this character that we really, really loved. He's nearly killed. It's this huge thing. And today I read an interview or an interview with Alan Ball, the director and writer, who said that about that episode, he said that that season four installment, let's see, this is not a direct quote from him, but this is what he was saying about it. That season four installment, which exemplified the kinds of narrative and emotional swerves that distinguished 6 Feet Under, was actually very explicitly inspired by the Pine Barrens episode of The Sopranos.
Interesting.
Said Paul, P-O-U-L, who was the producer who directed the episode. He said, like Pine Barrens, the episode begins in a traditional fashion and then transforms into something darker and more enigmatic, flitting between Fisher storylines before settling in with David and the cruel, capricious driver who simultaneously frightens and attracts him. He said that we were a little surprised by the vehemence with which some people objected to it. As other people said, that was the most exciting hour of television I've seen in a year. So,
interesting.
Yeah. So the idea of those two shows existing simultaneously, like Sopranos coming out 2 years before this, like they were in conversation with each other in interesting ways.
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So that is one small Jersey connection, which it's bigger than the only other one I found. So
which was, you're going to save that?
Or you it's not worth now? Saving.
Okay. Yeah. Let's just talk about it because neither is mine.
The only other one I found is that Bobby Cannavale plays Keith's a coworker of Keith in like season four for an episode or two.
I mean, it counts.
I know, but it's kind of,
and just for our listeners, is Bobby from?
He's from Union City. Yeah.
Is okay. Yeah. I just, you know, and obviously
he's very Jersey coded, but yeah, he's also from Jersey.
He's not just Jersey coded.
Yeah. He's actually
from. Yeah, the other thing that is Jersey coded in the show, I feel like, is that he, in the flashbacks, their dad is openly smoking while preparing a body. And I can't totally explain why, but that does feel very Jersey to me.
His dad, like, thank God they use this format of like the dead kind of existing in real life.
Great. I liked that so much.
Because his dad is such an amazing character. And if he just existed as like the catalyst for all of this, his death, the show would not be nearly as interesting. Like, I know we're here to talk about the pilot, but I heard, or
disclaimer, as of last week, we're going to be
spoiling,
not too precious about spoilers for these shows.
But I found a Slate article from like 2013 about this idea of a gateway episode, which I thought was something interesting in connection to a pilot and a finale, is this idea of the gateway episode, which is like the episode that is the thing that will like drag you into the show for real. And 6 Feet Under, their pilot is not the gateway episode. And I agree with this statement. There's, I think they list.
It's fascinating. I'm obsessed already.
I know.
I'm going through all of our shows.
Yeah. So the gateway episode for 6 Feet Under, according to this article in Slate written by Miriam Kruel, is season one, episode six, called The Room. And it has to do with Nathaniel, the father, and his sort of secret life. And like, not secret life in like the trashy way, but like just the parts of someone's life you don't know about when they're your parent.
Right, right.
You know, it's so good.
Now, is that in theory an episode, like if you were trying to get your friends at home into this show, would you say just start with episode six and if you like it, go back to episode one?
Yes. So basically the way they refer to this is, so the intro to the article says, and this is from 2013, summer is here, the perfect time to catch up with a few of those shows everyone is always saying you should watch, but there are so many. How can you decide which to try? You need to find the gateway episode. One you can watch without any background knowledge and which will give you a real sense of the show and whether you'll like it. So they're arguing that the gateway episode is season one, episode six. I would say season one, episode three also, Foot, is another one that could really give you the sense of it.
I know it's not the point now, but if I were listening right now, I would be Googling. So instead, can you just run through some of these? How many shows do they do? What do they cover?
Let me pull this up. So,
and also, what do we think Yellow Jacket's gateway episode is?
Yeah, I know. I think we might need to think about that and come back to it because I'm not. So I don't know if they use this framework a lot. There's one, a Silicon Valley skeptic's advice.
I need 20 shows
listed out
with the gateway episode.
I know. I agree.
They fucked up for us.
I agree. Oh, here we go. Okay. I found some. They just didn't use the phrase in the title every time. Okay, so they have Sopranos, Gilmore Girls, X-Files, Happy Endings, a show we have briefly mentioned before.
Also, Happy Endings got really screwed when they aired because they aired their show totally out of order. And so if you watched it week to week, it was very confusing.
Yeah.
And so that gateway episode, I'll bet, is very important.
Yeah. So there is, oh my gosh, they have a bunch. So Mad Men, Always Sunny, 6 Feet Under.
What's the gateway for Always Sunny?
Let's see. With 94 episodes to choose from and another 13 to start airing tomorrow. This came out in like 2013. Season 2's Dennis and Dee Go on Welfare.
Perfect. Perfect choice. That's a perfect choice. What a show.
Sex and the City, Boardwalk Empire, The Office, Bunheads, which I actually watched, Veronica Mars, What's Deadwood. So you want to know which one was Veronica Mars?
Yeah.
Okay. This I just have to say, Veronica Mars is a show that I watched only because I was working in the cage at my grad school, meaning the equipment rental, photo equipment rental place, working with people about 10 years younger than me. And we sat through hours and hours and hours of nothing happening in the basement of like the grad school. And all they did was watch Veronica Mars.
I love that
show. It's a great show. I mean, it was like, I would not have watched it without the influence of people 10 years my junior, but it was a great show.
That show has a great pilot, a great first episode. I don't know that it's one we'll need to watch for this, but it's great.
Yeah. So the episode that they recommend is the fourth episode of season one, The Wrath of Khan. And the synopsis is, in an effort to help Wallace's new friend, Georgia, who is duped out of her money in an internet scheme, Veronica must outwit a group of computer thugs known as the Silicon Mafia.
That's right. Oh, yeah, that is very good. That,
yeah.
Man, that show rules.
There's also a one for Buffy, which I'm sure you'll probably want to know. Mm-hmm. BoJack Horseman, Futurama.
Gonna need Buffy. Gonna need...
So, okay, Buffy gateway episode is... let's see. Start with Earshot, the 18th episode of season 3.
That's kind of late in the game.
Yeah. Well, the argument here is, and you may disagree with this, seasons 1 and 2 of Buffy relied a bit much on excessively campy bad guys, fish monsters, a ventriloquist dummy, etc., which I'm sure you love. The bad guys of season 3, on the other hand, embody villains we all know. Adolescent alienation, romantic jealousy, teenage insecurity, high school frenemies, parents who just don't understand.
It is very... teen drama / monster of the week those first two seasons, and it looks so stupid, and I have a lot of love for that,
of course. Yeah,
but the show, yeah I mean, totally.
Yeah,
but for me, I'm kind of like, if you can rock with season one, like, you're gonna be obsessed with the show.
There's also an article by Inku Kang, who is a person whose writing I have liked, that says this is 2019, what a new generation of feminists can gain from watching Daria, which I need to read. So Community, I wonder what the Community one was.
Yeah, because that's tough, because that show is so silly every week, but it starts out like the for
and
me it's
really
like
specific
the, right. I think the thing that shifts for me is the way they treat those characters, because like Troy being the like meathead when he's so not after about three or four episodes, like,
I know. Okay, instead the best place for newcomers and skeptics to begin is season 2's Cooperative Calligraphy. It's essentially a bottle episode in which the main cast is confined to the study room for the duration. The premise is simple. Annie has a purple gel grip pen that goes missing as the group ends a study session. She wants to know which one of them has taken it. It's a 20-minute Agatha Christie style mystery.
God, that show's so good. This is just, we'll just have an hour of you reading this article to me and me saying, God, that show's so good. All right, let's pick one more. Go ahead.
So Breaking Bad is another one. You didn't watch Breaking Bad, right?
Oh, yeah, I did.
Oh, you did. Okay. I couldn't remember if we talked about that. It was The Wire that you didn't watch that I thought you had.
I've seen some of The Wire.
Yeah. Let's see. As a former member of the Breaking Bad Skeptics Club, I can tell you there is hope. Not only that, I can also tell you the secret to converting to the cult of Heisenberg. Skip the early Mr. Chips episodes and jump right into the one that introduces Walter White's Scarface alter ego. Specifically, pick up the show at season 1, episode 6, Crazy Handful of Nothing, otherwise remembered as the very first Tuco episode.
Yeah. Correct.
This is a great sort of companion
premise for a
idea.
Podcast?
I know it is.
And somebody has already done it. I don't know if this podcast is any good, so I don't want to recommend it necessarily. But there is a podcast called Gateway Episodes. And I have not listened to it. But if you are looking for someone, or if you are like me kicking yourself.
Right.
I don't know if the show's any good. It looks like it didn't have too many listeners, which is not the show's fault or problem. Mm-hmm. It is unlikely that anyone will have heard of this podcast. And like I said, I can't recommend it in either direction.
Yeah.
But its first episode is Lost's The Constant, which is a perfect episode of that show. Though I cannot imagine, if you're a Lost fan like I am, and I say The Constant, you know exactly what episode that is. And I just cannot imagine showing somebody that episode as the first one. There's so much that goes into that episode, but it is a fantastic, incredible, I cry until like I have a headache episode.
Huh. That's all the way in season 4.
Yeah, it's...
Sorry, I was trying to remember what episode that was.
This is how I know Lost isn't part of your...
I know. I mean, I watched it.
Yeah, it just didn't make its way into your DNA, which is fair and fine.
So, going back to 6 Feet Under, the show that we are here supposedly to talk about. No, it's okay. That did make its way into my DNA. For some obvious reasons, I mean, I can talk forever about why I love this show, but we do also kind of want to stick to... talking about the pilot. Mm-hmm. I am really curious to hear your reaction to the pilot, because I felt like I was back with old friends, and that is not maybe not as indicative of what someone's reaction to it would be, especially now. Like, we should stipulate, like you said, this aired in 2001. It started airing 3 months before September 11th. Like, what a wild time to be alive.
Side note, and then I'll put the Gateway Episodes thing to bed, is that when we get 10 million downloads,
yeah,
and we start our Patreon,
yeah,
we will do a monthly bonus episode where we visit a Gateway episode of one of the pilots every month that we've covered.
Done.
So now I can put that on the back burner.
Great.
Anyway,
so for those people that didn't watch the pilot, should we do just a quick... I have the synopsis.
Yeah, I think it's contained enough that we can...
Yeah. So I might just read this. I know that it's like maybe not as interesting, but it'll help me organize my thoughts as well, I think.
Yeah.
So the official synopsis is: Los Angeles, Christmas Eve. Nathaniel Fisher, owner of Fisher & Sons Funeral Home, is killed when a municipal bus broadsides his new hearse. The tragedy casts a pall on the holiday homecoming of son Nate, who works for an organic food co-op in Seattle, which is a detail that I absolutely love, as he must not only deal with the death of his father, but the fragile egos of Mother Ruth, who I could talk about for 100 years.
Oh, my God.
Who has been having a secret affair with her hairdresser, Hiram.
Incredible.
Brother David, a closeted homosexual, seeing a black policeman named Keith. Again, could talk about this forever. And a sister, Claire, a rebellious high schooler who receives the bad news after smoking crystal meth is not a thing, with new boyfriend, Gabe. Claire is my, like, I don't even know. I think I mentioned to you earlier, she was like my id.
Mm-hmm.
This you can disagree with. The only good thing to happen to Nate is Brenda, a passionate woman he met on the plane just before learning of his father's death. At home, David eschews the talents of his young mortician, Frederico, to personally undo the damage of his dad's accident. The ensuing funeral leaves the family's deepest emotions exposed and calls into question some of our more absurd rites of passage. At the gravesite, David is not amused by the advances of Matthew Gilardi of Croner Service Corporation, a funeral home conglomerate looking to buy out the Fisher's business. As for senior Nathaniel, he may have been laid to rest, but he has plenty left to reveal to his family. So...
yeah, where do you want to start? You just want my initial...
I want your initial reaction, and then maybe we'll go through the sort of like big questions we have about the pilots that we're talking about in general.
I was expecting a show that was a little more, serious, little more... I was surprised at the humor.
Yeah.
And the kind of like, it's dark. It's definitely dark, but it's got a lightness to it. It is way more, and I should have known, but it was way more black comedy than I was expecting. I didn't know that about this show. I think I was expecting something more like The Sopranos, but instead of our job is mafia, our job is funeral home.
Sure. Yeah. I can see that. I mean, especially time frame, HBO, like, I think also part of the reason you maybe had that impression is because the show went on for 5 seasons. And by the end, the characters in it were so beloved in such a serious way that, like, there are people, me included, who think the finale of this show was like, it was like I was sobbing at the finale of this show. And so even though it has this very, like, dark, I would say black comedy, like, aesthetic, especially in this pilot episode.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you is how much this tone carries into the show. Because, like, the stuff with the commercials.
I know.
And, like, Federico's bit where he's, like, showing his, like, greatest works. And then he picks up the picture of his kid and is like, it's so,
I know,
so funny.
Yeah, Rico is an interesting character as the show goes on. So tonally, I think it deepens is what I'll say. Mm. If you just watch the pilot, you would get a sense of the sense of humor, the main characters, which, you know, we'll talk about all of that. But there's a campiness that continues, but is maybe tempered a little, which in the long run, I think is a good thing and is what allowed people to really attach to the characters. Because if they stayed as sort of surface level over the top as they are in this first episode, I don't think people would have had the same intense attachment to them. Mm-hmm. I think, which is, like, you know, not surprising for a pilot, you only have an hour.
Right.
But, like, so speaking of the commercials, the one thing that does get dropped from the pilot moving forward, there's a couple major changes. One is the commercials disappear. They were originally meant to be a continuous part of the show, aww, but I think, I know, but I do think that if they did that every single week, it would take away from the gravity of some of the, like I said, it gets really serious here and there. Like, there's an abortion plot. There is, like, the carjacking plot. There's a lot of death. There's a lot of, like, really dramatic moments that I think if you interspersed it with those commercials continuously, it would have taken away from the sort of more serious part of the show, because the show continues to have that lightness and that humor, but it's more about the characters and their personality traits and not inserted by, like, some overlord, you know, editor making jokes.
That makes sense.
Yeah. I think it was a wise decision. I think that the commercials, I forgot about them completely because they don't stay a part of it. But. Right.
And I can also imagine that they would, that could get tiresome.
I think that would be old by, like, 3 or 4 episodes in.
But I thought they really, like,
they're so funny, though.
They're so funny. And they really made me be like, oh, it's that kind of show immediately.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, good, good. Because I obviously, like, I think by now we've established, like, that tone, this kind of thing is totally, totally my thing. So,
yeah. I mean, all sorts of stuff, like, that the type of humor that continues is the kind of thing where Ruth is on the phone with Nathaniel Sr. saying, like, that, you know, he needs to stop smoking or he's going to die a slow, painful death. And then, like, 2 minutes later, he's hit by a bus. Like, that's the kind of humor that they keep. The thing that's different about the pilot from the rest of the seasons also is the fact that the death in this episode is connected to the family, right? Other deaths happen that are, like, loosely connected to the family, but this instigating moment of the father's death is, it's like, it sets up the structure going forward of a death that's starting each episode, but the rest of the deaths are often strangers that the funeral home is servicing.
It's funny because a show like this, it seems like the way to the way I might have assumed this episode would show up in a show like this is like season one finale. You set up the premise, you see how these people act and respond to death around them and how they're kind of callous about it in a lot of ways, whatever, and then it's like, right, but what happens when it comes home? And they don't do that. I think it's really cool. I think it's kind of I don't know, I think it's really smart.
Well, and, like, one of the things the show became known for was the sort of unconventional way that it structured itself and the way it did these things, right? So there's a lot of, and again, if you don't want any spoilers, don't listen to the rest of this episode. I'm not gonna overtly spoil things. I'm gonna try to be careful because I do think there is a chance that Andrea, someday you may actually watch it.
But I'm also not. Have we talked about one of my greatest serial killer traits?
What, that you don't care about spoilers?
Well, it's not that I don't care about spoilers.
Do you two puzzles at the same time? Like Walter?
I will, like, there's a real chance that whether I'm going to watch 6 Feet Under or not, I will go read the Wikipedia breakdown of every episode when we're done here. And then still go back and watch the show.
And it's worth it. Like, so one of the things that gets teased on and off throughout the series is Nate, the son, going to die? Because he is so connected to his father by name and by lots of other things we discover. And we find out some health stuff later on. And there's all of these, like, and it's kind of an ongoing, like, who else in the family might we lose?
And then also for me, just as a new person watching, I'm like, everyone else is so entrenched in death in this show that it's like, I can't imagine any of them are really fearful of it. But Nate has been so
away from it.
So
that's like one of his defining characteristics is that he runs away from these things.
And so it wouldn't be surprising if we were to lose him. I love Peter Krause, by the way. I don't know if anybody's canceled
this point. I don't think he is, but he was good in Sports Night.
I loved that show.
It was a good show.
I thought that show was great. Just know, listeners, if they are canceled, I agree. They should have been. He's blandly handsome in a way that I feel like as a queer woman, I should have more interesting tastes in men. But it's like he's got Joel McHale vibe. Like, two of them could play brothers and I would be thrilled.
Oh, I have some alternate casting that we can talk about.
Oh, I love alternate casting.
Yeah, I found out who they were considering for the brothers. So, OK, where's my alternate casting?
Oh, I think I found one.
Okay. So who did you find?
Chris Maloney and Justin Theroux?
Yes.
That's fun.
I know. Can you imagine Chris Maloney?
I guess so. Chris Maloney would be Nate and Justin Theroux would be
David? Dave,
or the other way around.
Oh, gosh.
What were you imagining?
I was kind of imagining the opposite, actually, because I feel like Justin Theroux, maybe I'm thinking of him in like later roles. I don't know. He strikes me more as the like flighty, like I could see him as the like Lothario. I don't know. There's something, maybe it's just a physical thing, there's something about like the sort of grounded stockiness of Christopher Maloney that resonates with David as like a very contained, tight person.
I guess I'm picturing Maloney yelling at that woman in the at the viewing when she's like, he's in a much better place now.
There are so many moments in this pilot where I was like, oh, that's why I love these people.
Like, Krause is so good. Some of his line deliveries, like that one where he's like, you're absolutely right about that. I forget exactly what he says, but the way he kind of like leans forward and yells it at her, like he's yelling at her, but it's also weirdly flat. I was like, I laughed out loud. You are so right about that.
Yeah.
He says.
And there's so many moments like that, that like where, so the thing with David and being so tightly wound, there's like the moment at the funeral, at his dad's funeral, where you see him scream and then you realize that he's doing that in his head. And then later on, he actually does it. And it's like the flipping back and forth between what's going on in their heads versus what's going on in reality doesn't get old to me. I feel like it is one of the things that like their interactions with the dead and their like, it's not so slippery that you're not sure what's happening.
No.
That's and the thing. You know what's in their head and what's not for the most part. And if you don't right away, you do immediately after.
You know what's funny? I'm glad you said that because there's another show that I keep saying it, to me, this pilot felt like in a way that I couldn't quite put my finger on because it's not a one-to-one. And I think that if you disagree with me, you will be well within your rights to. But I had the same feeling when I was watching this as I do when I watch certain episodes of Scrubs.
I can see that actually.
And like Scrubs, it's way more pronounced in like the dream world that they all kind of live in or that JD lives in is so cartoonish. And that's not the case here. But that little bit of unreality that's always kind of floating and it being willing to, because Scrubs can be so like to the point of melodrama sometimes, but will also be so funny. I felt the way I often feel when I watch Scrubs.
No, I can totally see that. I can totally
see
that.
That kind of stuff is part of it, I think.
So the areas we wanted to think about in relationship to all the pilots was the hook, the characters, world building, and your questions, right?
Thank you for trying to get us back on track, because
I'm doing my best.
You're doing great.
I could talk about, like, I just want to sit here and talk about Claire, and I want to talk about David and Keith. And, like, a lot of that has to do with what happens later. And so I'm trying to control myself from, like, getting distracted by thinking about the trajectory of these characters, because that's not what we're here to talk about. But right. I love them all so much. So in terms of the hook, what would you say the hook is of this pilot? Because it's very hard for me knowing what's coming.
It's a family of funeral employee. They're not all directors. It's
right.
a family who runs a funeral home.
Yes.
Coming together when the patriarch of the family dies.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, I feel like I'm, you know, this is like any sort of story writing. I was going to say screenwriting, but whatever, 101 is like, can you get it in a sentence?
Yeah.
And obviously that's much more than that, but
yeah,
that's it, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like,
or it's like, what happens when death comes home to a family who runs a funeral home?
Right.
Like, that's the real.
Yeah. And so based on that and based on this first episode, do you think it works?
Totally. What I like so much about it that they did right away that made me really jump in, because I'm wondering if part of what has made me not seek out the show faster, considering, and this is a weird thing considering my love for black comedy and horror and all of that, is like, I'm somebody who is like, I have like deep death anxiety. I'm like very afraid of death. And I think there was a part of me that was like, is this gonna gonna be too much for me?
Yeah.
But they handle it so matter-of-factly,
so
in a way
much,
that
yeah.
felt so soothing to me right
yeah.
away, and made me want to really keep watching. Like
yeah.
that, just that alone was like really compelling to me.
That's so interesting, because so when I watched this show the first time, my dad was alive, right? Mm-hmm. So I didn't have the same, like, I actually had some trepidation this time, you know, because my
right.
dad died like 12 years ago, and I hadn't really sat down and watched most, I think I'd watched the pilot again once or twice, but and I dipped back in and out a little bit, but like, I was so, so, so involved in this show when it came out, like emotionally. And so I was a little worried about that. And what I ended up finding that it did for me was like, it made me a little sad because the dad stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, dad warning, like, you know, but also it made me wish that my dad just randomly showed up sitting on his car places to talk to me.
Isn't it weird that it doesn't, it's so sweet and soothing,
yeah.
but it doesn't feel saccharine.
No.
And it doesn't feel like, because it could.
Yeah.
Even in a show like this.
Yeah.
That like, it could feel saccharine or like cheesy, maybe.
I think what you feel in those moments when they see or talk to their dad, and this continues, is that you feel like it's a continuation of the relationship they already had.
Mm-hmm.
So like, you know, Nate ran away from his dad and his dad's business. And like, when he interacts with his dad in real life, you feel that connection between the two of them, that they're very similar, but also extremely different. You also feel it when David talks to him, the different type of relationship. And then especially in this, when you see Claire talking to him, when they're just hanging out after the funeral.
Yeah.
I immediately got emotional because I was like, that is old dad, young daughter, sort of like, you know, daughter that got a little too much freedom because the parents were tired. And like, you know, I have two older brothers from my dad's first marriage that are much older than me. I never lived with them, just like Claire, like really never lived with Nate. And like, there's just something about the sort of like casualness of their relationship where, you know, he treated her like an adult way too early, but also like, then they were able to have interesting conversations. Like, I just felt like it wasn't like, oh, the dead father is visiting. It was like, no, this father is visiting this child.
Mm-hmm.
It felt very specific.
Yeah, totally.
I think that's like the specificity of these characters, even in the first episode where they could be a little bit caricature-ish. It's, I feel like it's enough, at least for me, that enough specificity and enough like surprises.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
David is a really good example of
that.
And
I love
just,
that everyone's like, you know, a cop. Why do you know a cop?
Yeah, right. And it's not just the closeted part that's a surprise.
It's not.
I watched the first few minutes of David that we get, and I was like, oh, right, this is why he's Dexter. He seems so contained and also disconnected and also just like I was like, this guy feels like a serial killer and I don't know if I'm going to like him. Yeah. And then it so clearly becomes that that's not really what he is, that he just seems so tender.
I love
like,
David.
Tender in like an open nerve way where he's like,
yeah,
he's got to be that buttoned exactly up it. Because if you poke it, it's yeah, going to.
He is. And, he's an open nerve.
Yeah. And it's.
I love him so much.
Like, honestly, happily surprised by that.
It's so funny that you say that because I was shocked at him playing Dexter. I never watched Dexter because mm-hmm. I was so attached to him as David. I couldn't even imagine it.
Funny.
But that's because as the show goes on, he morphs and changes and grows mm-hmm. and is not the same person he is in this episode. Like, he still has the tendencies. He's still a control freak. He's still mm-hmm. like difficult to budge on things and all of that. But he does, like, this isn't a big spoiler, by the end of the first season, he does come out to his family.
Oh, and, good. Like, I was so worried that we were going to have to watch.
No, they don't belabor him. It.
Oh, thank God.
They don't belabor it at all. He comes out, everybody's supportive. Like, you can see it in Claire's face.
Yeah, that little moment is so sweet.
I know.
When he, like, just all of it where he's like, because I started to get, I hate that trope. And I know it's only, it's 2001, so we're still pretty, but the, like, really like so painfully closeted that they're cruel to the person who right. they're involved with.
Yes.
And he does it a little, but I'm also like, this is what's, I'm like, yeah, but Keith, now is not the time. Like, you, I know you want to be here for him, but you shouldn't have.
Exactly.
And so when he like puts his hand on the side of David's face and David pushes his hand away, I'm kind of like, in any other instance, I'd be pissed at David, but I sort of get it. But then he kind of nudges him with his shoulder, David does, in a way that's like still kind of sweet. And I'm like, it's cool to see that relationship be a little complicated there, where like mm-hmm. David isn't just being cold. And then, you see what's
Claire
her name on
see
the show?
Them.
Yeah. And she's like clearly tickled by it in a nice way. She's like, oh.
Well, and one of the really beautiful things that happens in the show that I really loved is they feel like three separate people in the beginning that have left, mm-hmm. led three separate lives. Like, they mm-hmm, left.
Totally.
David is the old responsible brother that's almost like not present at all in Claire's life, even though mm-hmm. they are still in the same place physically.
Mm-hmm.
And Claire is off on her own. And as they are, like, it's no big secret. Obviously, Nate doesn't leave. Right? Like,
right.
you know, that's kind of the premise of the show mm-hmm. is they're all in the same place again. They get integrated into each other's lives more. They actually get to know each other for that's the first sweet. Time kind mm-hmm. of as siblings. I mean, like, Nate and David had a relationship when they were growing up, but they also get to know each other as adults. And like, Claire gets to see her brothers as full humans and not these like missing, absent people.
Right.
And this is like that first little moment of her being like, wait a minute.
Mm-hmm. That scene at the grocery store with her and Nate, when she freaks out and throws the melon and then like leans into his chest and then yells at the guy. It's like, that's the other thing that we could probably spend a whole episode on is the watching all these different people who are always surrounded by grief, not their own, but then to see how they all respond and process
incredible.
Their own grief in the way that the show chooses to show that
right.
is so cool.
And David as like the representation of like this buttoned up sort of like, we have to do this in a certain way mm-hmm. because this is soothing to people. And then
and
like,
he's kind of right. Like, I
they're all so, right.
Yeah, that's what's again really cool about it is that like when Nate starts picking up the dirt and is like, you know, saying like, and it's like, oh, I get it. The metaphor, you have to get your hands dirty.
Yeah.
I'm like, he's kind of right. And then when David yells at him for it, I'm like, he's also kind of right.
Yep. And like, who hasn't been too high in the wrong situation at one point?
Right.
Her on like her she's smoking crystal meth and then immediately finding out she had to go like drive her mom to the funeral home because her dad
so
died
funny.
Is like the extreme version of that. But it is like, and when I first watched this show, I had very recently done some drugs I shouldn't have done, like a few years prior. So I think I was very connected to the experience of Claire just being like, I should not be high right now. Oh, God.
Good.
But her, so I wrote down in my notes when I was watching it this time, is this overacting or is this actually incredibly accurate to being a teenager? And I feel like thinking about myself and why I related to Claire so much, mm-hmm. I was that angsty and crazy and like...
And there are moments where she's not doing that.
Yeah.
So
no, I think it's actually like kind of accurate. Mm-hmm. Her throwing the cantaloupe is just perfect.
Yeah. I do... Yeah, it's such a perfect, just like, there are a few different things, like what's his face screaming in his head the first time, but like,
yeah,
those little outbursts, I love.
Well,
and they
Ruth,
all have them. Oh my God.
The mom.
She is incredible.
I could talk about Frances Conroy forever in this show.
She's incredible.
She continues to be. This is like, this episode introduces her range, but like, she is, oh, there's a great description of her that I found in an article. Hang on, I got to find it right now because it's perfect. Where is it? Because she, I both adore and hate her throughout this entire series because of my own mother issues. Like, there's...
Jody, that scene
I
where
know.
She confesses that she's having an affair in the middle of their father's funeral.
I she's was a just narcissist.
Like, oh, my God. Yeah, that was rough for me. Where when one of them is like, should you really be like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I apologize to whoever wrote this because I did not write down where I found this, but there's a description of her. It says, there's something about the way Ruth speaks, her careful consideration of words that she then just spurts out that's utterly captivating. Her way of speaking in short declarative sentences feels almost Hemingway-esque. If Hemingway were a redheaded, middle-aged housewife who didn't know anything about her children, had a borderline inexplicable sex appeal.
Jody, I Andrea. Almost texted you and I was afraid you were going to take this as an insult. hold on. Also, it's... Miriam Krull is
oh,
the
it
article.
Is.
It's from
that?
The Gateway
okay.
episodes article, actually.
Perfect.
I said there's... I almost texted you, why does she feel like she's in, like, one of those movies where they're still doing that mid-Atlantic accent?
Mm. Because she is, like, a sort of throwback mother figure.
Yeah.
Like, she's
and
not
she's
a
like
modern
in the
mother.
Apron. She's talking like a Hemingway character.
Yeah.
She's got a weird sort of affected accent.
Yeah.
And then also, that is gone when she's giving that broke down confessional. Like, it totally falls away. It's so cool.
One of the things I love about the portrayal of her in this show is that she's an older woman who's lost her husband, who continues to be sexual throughout the entire series.
Good for her. Get it, girl.
Yeah. And I mean, we find out in this first episode that she cheated on her husband. Mm-hmm. Like, for long periods of time with her hairdresser.
I went camping several times.
It's so good. But, like, she continues to date and to, you know, meet men and figure out, like, herself after the loss of her husband. Like, she continues to become... She's still a challenging mother, right?
Right.
Like, she's still... There's a scene where she slaps Claire way later on, right? Mm. And there's, like, these relationship things between them that are fascinating. But she's a full human with, like, sex drive and love interests and all of that.
And it's that phone call, because it's all we see of the two of them together, really, right, is that they have at the beginning where you can tell, like, there's still love there. Like, she feels really, she's been cheating on her husband, but, like,
yeah,
you can
but
tell
they've been
that,
together for a million years. And,
yeah.
You know.
And I like that he doesn't feel like the family villain, that Mm-mm. it's not, like, good riddance, dad's dead because
right.
or that, like
no
that she
it's not
was, like,
that at all
this like abused woman. You don't get like right. any of that. They just had a
yeah
I think it's a pretty realistic
yeah
maybe not the cheating and going camping with the hairdresser and all of that part of it, but yeah. I think their dynamic and their feelings feel really real.
And that continues. And that's
cool.
The thing that's kind of cool about it, because you think, okay, the first episode the dad dies, we don't get to learn more. But we do, because it continues to come back. And you would think that would get old, but it actually doesn't because of the way it's handled. It, like, only happens – it's not like he's constantly there being like, hey, guys, what's up? You know,
right.
It's like when he is needed, he appears in the – you know, whether it's – an actual ghost of their father, if you want to believe it that way, or like their subconscious, like inhabiting his form to like when they need guidance. But he does continue to show up in interesting moments, and you continue to see the development of his, like, his relationship with his children. And it's super interesting to think about if it is their projection of him,
mm-hmm.
how, this is going to get super deep real fast, how your relationship with a parent changes after their death.
Mm-hmm.
Like any new relationship that you develop with them is one-sided.
Totally. Yep.
Right? Like if you discover something about your parent after the fact, you are having a new one-sided relationship with that person.
Mm-hmm.
Like I talked to my father's first wife a couple years ago, and she was really generous with me and like talked to me about, because they had an ugly divorce, but like it's been a million years.
Right.
She talked to me about a little bit of what he was like when they first got married and like when he worked for the post office and all this stuff. And it was like, that's a new relationship that I have with my dad, but he's not having it with me, you know? And it's so fascinating to think about that, like being portrayed in a show. You never see this kind of thing where it's like the deceased parent is like such a, like blank slate for each child in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It's really cool.
That is cool. And it's, I mean, shout out James Cromwell too. He's like, this show's so well cast so far for me.
They wanted like a movie star in that role and they convinced, Alan Ball, I think, convinced HBO. HBO was very hands-off with the show, actually, which I think really, you can see. I mean, Alan Ball, the director, had his main credit before this was American Beauty. And after it did True Blood. And so it's such a interesting like path. But also Alan Ball is gay and like puts a lot of his own experiences into David. He says that like each of the three characters are a piece of him. Like David is his experience with being queer and like the way he navigated that. Nate is like a part of his experience of like, you know, being more flighty or whatever. And Claire is like his, like, sincere artistic side, wanting to, like, make an artistic difference in the world, because she does become, later on, like, an actual artist, goes to art school. So, you know, I think some of the sensitivity to the, and we didn't even really get into the queer stuff, but, like, later on, that's much more visible.
Mm-hmm.
Also, interesting cast, not casting, people involved in this, Joey Holloway, Soloway, of Transparent, was one of the writers on season two, I believe, and became a co-executive producer in the fifth season.
Interesting.
Yeah. So there's, and there's connections between this and Transparent, I think, casting wise also, that relate to that.
Wow. Transparent is 10 years old now.
That's so crazy.
That feels, I would have been like, you know, that show from a couple years ago.
I know. The other thing, oh, I meant to say this when we were talking about David or Michael C. Hall. One of the reasons he has said that he was glad that David was like a super uptight character. This was his first on camera role.
Whoa.
He was doing Cabaret.
Really?
Yeah. He was on Broadway in Cabaret when he got cast in this, I believe.
Amazing.
Or right about then. And he was on Broadway after this in Hedwig and the Angry Inch. He's like a theater guy originally. And so he'd never acted on camera before this show. He was super nervous. And so it like played into the David character.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Oh, I've been totally neutral on him. And I've just, over the course of the last 4 hours since I watched it this morning, just am falling in love.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's this, honestly, that's why I couldn't watch Dexter. It's not just because I don't like bloody things. Like I kind of don't. But I can deal with it if there's another reason.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, there was a reason not to watch Dexter, which was that I didn't want Michael C. Hall and David in my mind to turn into Dexter.
And it's so funny because in my head, again, this was trouble to meet almost immediately. But those first few minutes with him, I was like, oh, I get it. I get it. This is a guy who, like, in the way that the Jigsaw killer from the Saw movies is grown up Macaulay Culkin, I'm like, oh, so Dexter worked at a funeral home and got too into it, and now he's a, you know, like, but then again, like I said, that's immediately troubled. But yeah, he seems lovely in this, and yeah.
The format of this, I think, the starting with a death every episode, again, it's another thing that you would think would get like kind of contrived after a while.
It's going back to that operational theme of it being like sort of, this show, it's kind of procedural in a way. Instead of a case, it's a death.
Every episode, there's a death that they have to deal with, and it somehow informs what happens to them or what they're thinking about or like is the instigator of something. And I was looking back at the Wikipedia page with all the episodes, Because I was trying to remember, like, I remember some of the deaths being like, some of them are funny, some of them are really dramatic and scary. Like, one is a workplace shooting. Oof. Like, in 2002.
This feels like House to me, where it's like each episode is a medical case, and sometimes, and like, do they, are these, is this an excuse for the show to bring in guest stars for an episode who are,
weirdly,
do they do that a lot? No?
They have big stars come in for guest roles, but they're often more like, they're not the deaths usually.
Oh, cool.
The deaths are often just random people. But like, Kathy Bates is in this show for a few episodes. And she's fun. Great in it.
I can't wait.
She's great. But so the reason I bring that up is because I was going back and looking at the different deaths to remind myself of kind of where they went with it. And one of the funniest ones that I had completely forgotten about, I started laughing so hard when I read this. Okay, I have to read this to you. This is like season four, please, the quote-unquote crazy season. Mm-hmm. This is season four, episode two. Dorothy Sheedy, a 49-year-old deeply religious woman, mistakes floating inflated sex dolls for the rapture, and while distracted is fatally struck by a car.
Perfect.
Like,
perfect.
And the next, like, you know, there's also like a workplace shooting and an accidental suicide and like,
but that's very real life, right? Like, some deaths are stupid.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Somebody dies falling in the shower. Like, you know, there's
right,
all
and some deaths are totally mundane. Like,
yeah. Yep. Yeah. It's wild. But I think they do a good job of keeping that surprising enough that it doesn't get super repetitive.
What a fun thing in the writer's room to be like, all right, what's it going to be this week, guys?
I know. I know. Oh, that must be so great. So let's, trying to keep us mildly on track, let's talk characters. So we are introduced to our main cast. There's like one person that becomes a much more main character who we see very briefly. But for
is
the most
Jeremy
part.
Is that Jeremy Sisto is my guess?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
The brother, Billy. But for the most part, these people become this focal point of the show.
Brother. She calls him hun or honey, and I thought partner. I was like, is she the kind of jackass who has gone home, who is like cheated on her partner and told him and then is just being totally nonchalant about it?
That's her brother.
Cool. She sucks.
I know.
I do not like her. I can't tell if the show wants me to think she's like interesting. I will say, I'm sorry, Jody. I loved this pilot. I will likely end up watching more of this show. I thought it was great. It like struck all of the things I like, except
her.
She is such a miss for me.
I know. I will say she gets better. She gets redeemed somewhat as a personality type. She's very one note in this first episode.
She's so manic pixie dream girl.
I know, but there are more notes to come. So I just say keep an open mind. You're not going to fall in love with her, but you may tolerate her more because you may realize there's more to her than they've given her in this first episode. There's only so much they can do in 60 minutes when they have to set up the family.
Yeah, that makes sense. They give her – she gets a lot of time in this episode, though.
Well, she's a major character in the show, and she gets more – she gets a lot more depth and gets more interesting as it goes on. But I think in some ways she's a little bit of a – she is a little of the manic pixie dream girl in that she is meant to trigger something innate.
Right.
But what that something is gets more complicated later on.
That makes sense. But if what we're evaluating right now is like hits and misses of a pilot and what these characters set up for us.
Absolutely.
She's the only one I'm not interested to learn more about at this point.
Totally agree. Yeah. Totally understand that. Yeah. I mean, I think if you think about sort of the like one sentence description of each person, there's a quote from Alan Ball about the title, and he says, 6 feet under refers not only to being buried as a dead body is buried, but also to the primal emotions and feelings running under the surface.
Right.
When one is surrounded by death, to counterbalance that, there needs to be a certain intensity of experience of needing to escape. Mm-hmm. It's Nate with his womanizing. It's Claire and her sexual experimentation. It's Brenda's sexual compulsiveness. It's David having sex with a male hooker in public, something that happens later on. It's Ruth having several affairs. It's the life force trying to push up through all that suffering and grief and depression. But yeah, I will agree completely that the other characters are set up with a little bit more complication and depth in that first episode than she is. I don't like her at all in the first episode.
And you're probably right, too, that – or you're not probably right. You're totally right. That part of that is like it is so much easier to make people more complex when they are already in relationship with one another and the family dynamic there.
She's like, brand new.
Yeah. Everything you learn about everybody informs what you know about everybody else. And she doesn't have that luxury. So that's, you know.
Yeah. Another fun thing about this show that I'd forgotten about is that similar to Lost, there is like additional content that came out to support the storylines in the show. So there was in 2003, they released 6 Feet Under, Better Living Through Death, which is a book. And it contained family trees, aww, documents from the childhood of the kids.
Oh, I would have loved that. I would have been obsessed.
Yeah. Nathaniel, the father's letters to Ruth from Vietnam, which is something that comes up later. Excerpts from the book about Brenda, that is a whole other thing. Plus a fan letter from 11-year-old David Fisher written to Matt Dillon. It's amazing. So, like, that extra content thing is something that they were doing also.
I love that. I'm such a sucker for that stuff.
I know. Oh, and Rico stays a pretty important character throughout, and so he's introduced here, too.
What a doll.
I know.
I love Freddy Rodriguez.
He's a little homophobic later on.
Oh,
he's not,
no.
We don't love him always, but he is definitely, he's important in this show in that he's like an outside perspective, but has been with the family for a really long time.
That's a cool.
Yeah.
It's got a little bit of, Cousin Richie vibes, not in manner or anything, but it's just so interesting to have. I've often been that person. I have like a small handful of families that I became very close with, and like being that kind of person where you're like sort of on the outside, but way more in than anybody else is. So you can really see a little bit of that, like Cousin Richie vibes for sure.
Well, there's also the idea of like his relationship to the father is explored further, but it's kind of mentioned here where they're talking about how David's not good at reconstruction and Rico's excellent at it. And like Rico was trained by Nathaniel and they worked together for a long time. And he was a little bit of like a prodigy and had a little bit of a like son relationship, it seems like, to Nathaniel. And so there's also that kind of complication.
Tension, yeah.
So, but yeah, the idea that Rico's like supremely talented at reconstruction and David isn't is a very funny thing that occurs in this show.
I love that. And that he's like just like a little bit of a silly guy.
Yeah, he is a silly guy.
While we're talking about Freddy Rodriguez, a lot of Can't Hardly Wait characters. I counted at least three. Lauren Ambrose, obviously. Denise Fleming from Can't Hardly Wait. Freddie Rodriguez is in Can't Hardly Wait. And so is Eric Balfour, who plays her like new boyfriend guy. So
who I was going to bring up. Yeah.
Yeah. I really like that. I really like what happened there? You know what I mean? Because that's statistically pretty high.
It is. To have at least three high people. Number of Can't Hardly Wait cast. Yeah, there's got to be some crossover there. But so Eric Balfour, who plays Gabe, isn't even credited with a name in this first episode because he was literally supposed to be like just a one-off, like her boyfriend triggering moment with the crystal meth.
One of the things I did know about the show watching it is that I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot. I knew that he's like a recurring character in the show. I don't know anything about him, but.
Yeah, he has a lot to do in the first season. It sort of trickles down later on because Claire has other love interests. Trickles down, trickles out, whatever, disappears because Claire has other love interests. But he has a pretty significant role in the first season. And it turns out that that happened mainly because they saw the chemistry that the two of them had in the brief interactions in the first episode. Cool. And they decided to keep him around, kind of like Lauren Ambrose. Well, not Lauren Ambrose, but Van. Younger version, Van. In, Liv Hewson,
I love learning stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, they liked their on-screen chemistry. And so they kept him around. And he has some pretty significant episodes in the first season.
Good for him. Good, I love that.
Almost want to insist that you watch at least through episode 6 of season 1 because episode 3 is like, ooh, it's got some good stuff in it.
Again, 10 million downloads.
Yeah.
We'll go right to Patreon.
Yeah.
I don't do anything for fun anymore. It's got to be for a podcast, so.
But no, I do really kind of want to insist that you watch at least through the first half of this season. So yeah, characters, I think knowing what I know about the later seasons and the later episodes, I think this is a good introduction to them. Mm-hmm. I think the only one that really falls short is probably Brenda, mm-hmm. because she is just so one note here.
And well, they did her a disservice by naming her Brenda. They set her up for failure.
Yeah. But for the most part, I think that you get enough of a hint at each person's character that is mm-hmm. accurate to what they kind of develop into that I think it's a good setup in that way.
And they feel, for me as a new viewer, complex and they feel already lived in, and there's stuff that we don't know about them, but that does exist off camera.
Yeah.
You can imagine their lives continuing when we're not watching them, which is hard to do for a pilot, I think.
I think so too. I mean, I think there's a reason, this pilot won a bunch of awards, and so did the show. It was sort of a critical success for most of its run. And there were people that thought season 4 was not great. And, I thought it kind of went crazy, but whatever. But the pilot episode, let's see, received nominations for art direction, makeup, editing, sound mixing. Alan Ball won for outstanding directing for a drama series at the Emmys. I think that for the first season, it won an Art Directors Guild Award for excellence in production design. It got 9 Emmys, 3 Screen Actors Guild Awards, 3 Golden Globes, and a Peabody Award over its run.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
That's really impressive.
Yeah. And like I mentioned before, last week, I think, and I'm not going to talk about the finale beyond this, but just that the finale is regarded as one of the most beloved finales of a beloved show for the way that it dealt with. The way that it really, how can I say this? Didn't betray its overall theme and focus with the finale. It honored it in a really nice way. So that's all I'll say.
Cool. That makes me more interested to watch it.
Yeah, the finale made me sob.
I love that. That's all you got to tell me.
Yeah, I cried a lot. I cried a lot.
Do you have, speaking of crying, this is, maybe we should add this to the criteria just because it's something that I care about.
Okay.
Are there certain episodes throughout the series of the show where I don't think you're as much of a crier as I am, but maybe not just you, but viewers of the show who love it.
Yeah.
When I think about Lost, the constant is I'm going to cry forever. There are a handful, but the constant is the cry until I want to puke.
Yes.
Buffy has the body. Buffy has Grave. Those two are going to make me cry until I can't breathe. Mm-hmm. We could go on and on. Are there episodes like that in this show that you can think of? Even if not for you, for other people?
Yeah.
I think the cryability factor is maybe something we should add.
So it's interesting because this show treats death so cavalierly that it doesn't ask that of you, but when it does, it has to do with the family itself mm-hmm. and other things going on in their lives. So mm-hmm. definitely, I think that this show dealt with pretty severe mental illness before a lot of other shows did, and mm-hmm. I think some of those episodes were really emotional. For me, the stuff that really always got me was Claire and her mom, because Claire's the youngest. She and her mom have a really fraught relationship, but also there's a lot of sort of similarities there, not just visually, but so there's definitely, I definitely cried a ton while watching this show. And I think a lot of it had to do with the family dynamics more so than what you would expect, which would be deaths.
Right.
But the finale, I just sobbed. I sobbed and sobbed and sobbed and sobbed.
That truly is the number one indicator for me that I should keep watching. I love to cry.
And there's lots of times where, there's a lot of family stuff that happens, not just with the actual family. So Keith and David are on and off for a long time. They mm-hmm. talk about starting a family and that's what I mean also about the sort of queer themes being more progressive for the time. There is a little bit of the every gay person is very slutty, but every person in the show is kind of slutty.
Right.
So it's not just the gay people. It's all the straight people too. They're all having a lot of sex.
It's interesting now to hear you say that and hear Alan Ball's line on that, of thinking of that as like a kind of like an equal and opposite reaction to how much death is in the show.
Yeah.
And that they both sort of come from the same drive is really interesting. Where like I could see me getting annoyed of being like, just everybody in the show has sex problems. Like that's kind of, but thinking
it's a
about
response.
It like, that makes so much sense.
Yeah. And I think it's pretty clear that that's what's happening all along. It's not like,
I also think if you have a show on HBO and you don't take advantage of the fact that you can have a lot of sex in your show, you're kind of missing the point. So good for them.
There's definitely, I cried on and off a lot in this show, and it was usually about the family relationships. Like there's just something very I feel like Alan Ball probably had a difficult mother. Like it's just so accurate in some ways to like you were saying about Ruth and the way that she makes the funeral about her. And also these are like narcissistic children too. They're all like, there's the moment where Nate says to Claire, "You're not the only one having this experience," or something like that. And that continually happens. And that's so realistic for somebody raised by a mother like Ruth, and a father who is running a funeral home and is in the basement with dead bodies all the time. Like they're going to be fucked up, and they're going to be a little like self-involved.
Yeah. How could you not be, right?
So, but I just, it's hard to imagine not crying at a show that deals with so many realistic and serious experiences that people have. Like just a handful of the deaths, right? Carl Willman, a 55-year-old serial killer, is executed in prison. Bruno Walsh, 21, gets high, jumps off a balcony, and is killed when he lands on a car. Oof. There's the sex doll lady. A 14-year-old dies suddenly at a sleepover. Like, someone's struck and killed by lightning. Someone falls in the shower. Someone's murdered in a home invasion. Someone dies of stomach cancer. So, like, any sort of family trauma experience you've had is going to somehow be referenced at some point.
Right.
An entire family is killed in a car accident. Like, someone's killed by the elevator doors closing on them. Like, it's just...
You've encountered one of my fears.
I guess so. That's Kenneth Henderson, in case you were curious.
Kenneth, oh no.
Yeah, he was 50.
Yikes.
But it deals really matter-of-factly with mental illness. And like, I have a feeling that if I rewatched the entire season, there would definitely be things I'd have a problem with. And I'm thinking specifically about Billy, because...
Who? Have I met Billy?
Oh, Billy is the brother. Billy is Brenda's brother that we meet.
Oh, Jeremy Sisto.
Yeah. He is... They refer to him in the first episode as manic depressive. This is like at that time frame. So Brenda in the car with Nate talks about her family and says she has a manic depressive brother. That's Billy.
Oh, and then, okay, I missed that line somehow. Maybe I was texting you. But so then when we encounter him sobbing.
Yes.
It's like, oh, because, you know, he's manic depressive. So he's either going to be so sad.
Yeah.
And now next time we see him, he's going to be like.
Yep. I do think that I would probably find problems with it in a rewatch. But also I'm curious because I think that I remember feeling like it was dealing with something that hadn't really been dealt with before in TV in a way that humanized in some way the people involved in it. So.
Right. Even if imperfectly.
Yeah. And there's a lot of talk about mental illness in it. Like there's people that go through like periods of like severe depression. It's not just Billy. Okay. So. Other than, so we've talked about the hook, the character, world building, I think we've kind of covered. Like, you know, it is setting up this very clear world of the funeral home. Los Angeles is a very sort of
it's almost like its own character.
Part of it. It's almost like a character. But it does, it feels very LA, the whole thing, the whole time.
Which I wouldn't have guessed. If you had told me about a show like this and then asked me where it would have been set, I would not have guessed LA. So that's like a cool kind of twist on that.
And later on, there's like some interaction with slash references to like the Topanga Canyon, like northern hippie culture up there that I think is also very site specific. That's interesting.
I want to touch a little bit too. So the world building and the literal space of it being an LA show set in a funeral home, that's all very clear.
Right.
And then for me, the thing that was a real hook is the world, the sort of like rules it sets up of that little bit of unreality, of that kind of like visually it's not super saturated, but it feels really intense. But also in a way that is, it feels really intense despite the fact that they're all so distanced and like, and buttoned up in their own ways. And
yeah, the colors are a little, I don't know if they're saturated, but they're shifted a little bit. There's just, there is a definite look to it that has, for me, I was like, well, is this just a 90s or early 2000s look? But I do think that there's something that they did in that opening. As soon as I heard that music, man, I was like, I'm in it. The theme is like incredible.
It felt to me, I was like, oh, I can see being somebody watching this at the time. And when those credits start, like clapping, like getting like real pumped.
And you see the tree and the crow and you're like, oh, I'm in it. Yeah. But yeah, there's something about the way that it is shot and filmed and edited that is just a very specific look that sets you up for that feeling of like unreality, but not so much that it is, it's like the unreality is like just adjacent, like you're in reality the whole time, but you know that you're in reality and you know that this other piece is here that's going to pop in and out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The veil is thin.
Yes. The veil is thin. Exactly. Exactly.
I'm still thinking about, because I said saturated and I don't want picky listeners to think I mean literally in the colors of it. And I'm trying to figure out why, because that kitchen scene in particular is not, it's the opposite. It feels purposefully washed out. I don't have the actual vocabulary. That's your world.
Just desaturated.
But for me, so the fact that I still feel that word and that I want to connect it that way is like, I think, I don't know exactly what's going on there, but it's really interesting. It feels really unique and it feels really specific to this show.
Yeah.
Or to this episode is as much as I can talk about it, but
I think you're right.
Like, I can't think of anything else that really looks like this.
Ooh, there's an article.
We should put that on the soundboard. Us being excited that we found an article.
The Funeral Parlor Palette, Color Symbolism and 6 Feet Under.
Totally.
I'm so excited.
I don't know if it'll come through in the recording, but Jody just literally
clapped. I'm totally reading this.
That's exactly what it is. It's the Funeral Parlor Palette. It's like throughout the whole, and those colors are so specific and they're not saturated, obviously, because it's still intense.
It's like, that like hospital morgue green teal that's everywhere, and like the deep red of like velvet and like.
I will say I'm very lucky that I haven't had a lot of death close to me. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother died when I was in high school. I've only been to a handful of funerals. I'm getting somewhere. When my dad died, I was in my early 30s, and I had to do all of the arranging and stuff. So I spent more time in a funeral home than I had ever wanted or expected to.
Yeah.
And I remember being so surprised at how much it looked like I was like, it's 2020, like whatever. Like, I'm surprised that it looks so much like a TV funeral home. Like they have, that has not, it's so distinct and it's still, and we just haven't updated it in 50 years, I guess. I don't know.
I think it might have to do with, like, to bring it back to the show, what David was talking about ritual and like, rigid boundaries of things being comfortable.
Yeah.
Like you don't want to walk into a funeral home and have it look like an Apple store.
I 100%, Jody, we are two different people, because I was about to say, I think I would have been comforted if I walked in. I swear to Christ, I was going to say, if I walked in and it looked like an Apple store.
That's so funny.
100%, that's what I was going to say.
That's so funny.
But yeah.
No, but people expect a certain thing. Mm-hmm. And when they're in the throes of like the worst grief is not the time to surprise them, maybe.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. No, I'm excited to look into this, because even just glancing at this article, it says 6 Feet Under featured a color palette that defined and linked all the major characters. Nate, David, Claire, Ruth, and Brenda were associated respectively with brown, red, purple, green, and blue. Ooh, is this an interview? American cinematographer from November 2002. has an interview with Alan Ball about the filming of this show.
Ooh.
I am excited about this. Okay. I will read this later. Cool. All right. So should we, what are the questions? This is our last thing. What questions does this set up for you?
This is interesting because this isn't, it doesn't feel like a mystery box show in the way that a lot of what we're probably going to cover is.
Mm-hmm.
So those questions are less obvious. It's like,
maybe more character based.
I was just going to say, what I'm interested to learn about these people is what their lives were like before their dad's death, what drove Nate away. I want to know so much about David and Keith's relationship. I'm interested knowing how many seasons this show gets, though I'm most interested to see how Claire changes, because she's at the right age for that. Like, she's going to be a little bit more of a young adult when we get to the end, so that'll be interesting to see. I am curious now, but this is more, has more to do with you than the show, to see how my feelings would change about Brenda over the course. Something that the show sets up for me is the fact that we still have Dad in the picture as a character leads me to believe that we're going to learn more about him and his backstory. And so I'm interested to see what kinds of, like, if he's hiding any secrets.
He's great.
Yeah, I think those are the big ones. This show is way more in line with to me. The pilot feels like it's way more in line with a show like House or something like that, where there's, I will be as interested to see what the little motifs are each week to week as I will be to learn about the family. And so I'm really interested to see that.
I feel like structurally you're right. It is. Yeah. Because it's, you do care about the characters, and you do, I think I care about these characters more than I cared about House and his doctors, although I did care about them. Don't get me wrong.
Okay.
But I am very attached to the Fisher family.
Well, and they're a family, and it does feel like just from the pilot, they are more interested in those characters than House.
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Was that, I think
House is more interested in House. The character, this show is more interested in the whole family.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah. I really hope you keep watching, because I kind of want to keep talking about it, like, offline.
I liked it a lot. I can't make promises, and it's if I'm gonna keep watching anything that I've encountered in the recent, you know.
Yeah.
In this season of my life, it's gonna be this for sure. I mean, it hit every, It ticks every box for me, for sure.
Yeah.
I had a guy really delighted in watching it.
Yeah. And this sounds crazy to say, but it's only 63 episodes.
I mean, that's kind of nothing.
Honestly, I mean, it had 13 episodes per season until the final season, and that had 12. So.
Yeah. I mean, that's totally manageable.
Yeah.
As opposed to Lost, where I'm like, I hope you, I know you watched it, but like,
I
hope you keep watching all 122 episodes of Lost.
I already went through that.
Yeah.
I already went through that. Yeah. And I enjoyed it. I really did at the time. I just, it's not something that I want to revisit. Although I will say that I did let Netflix or Hulu or whatever I was watching Lost on kind of like carry me through a few more episodes just because it was enjoyable to be there.
Mm-hmm. On the island with my friends.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk a bit about next week.
Mm-hmm.
So next week we are going to stay in the same general time frame, same network even. Mm-hmm. We just talked about how Six Feet Under and Sopranos were kind of back-to-back HBO Sunday night shows for many of the same years. And so it made sense for us to just kind of, since Sopranos was on our list, to go into that one next so we can think about the time frame, the general like media landscape, how they connect to each other, how they don't. We know that Alan Ball was watching Sopranos because he references Pine Barrens episode. Mm-hmm. So it should be an interesting next show to jump to.
And we'll talk a little bit more about this next week, but you've watched some Sopranos, is that right?
I have watched some Sopranos. So this is my memory, right? Everything is new when you have no memory. Mm-hmm. Every time I read a book or watch a TV show, unless it is the most meaningful thing in the world to me, it is gone from my brain instantly.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so that is what Sopranos was to me. It was meaningful because it was Jersey.
Right.
Other than that, I did not attach to it. So I honestly
So this will
cannot...
be a new experience for you as well.
Yeah. Like, I cannot remember how far I got into the show.
Okay.
6 Feet Under was my vibe. Sopranos was not.
Mm-hmm.
I was not interested in mob-based, male-dominated shows. I was interested in shows about a teenage girl who wanted to be a photographer.
Right. That makes sense.
And was involved with, like, mentally ill men. Like, that's mm-hmm. that was more my vibe. So
right.
I honestly cannot tell you how far I got into Sopranos. I know I watched a bunch of it, but I cannot remember when I stopped. So
here's what I've seen.
I know what you've seen.
I've seen The Many Saints of Newark.
Of all things.
And I've seen parts that I found on YouTube of the Pine Barrens episode so that I could pull some dialogue for my New Jersey Choose Your Own Adventure that I've been working on. And that is all I've seen of The Sopranos. And I know that it's sacrilegious of both of us, especially for as annoying as we are about being from Jersey. But I know people from Jersey are obsessed with the show, but it feels a little bit to me like this is not a judgment on the show itself, but I feel, and I will probably be proven wrong because the way our friends who do love it have talked about it is very genuine Jersey in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But I have always put it in the same category as the Jersey Shore, where I'm like, that's Jersey for people who aren't from Jersey.
Right.
And I think I'm going to be proven wrong.
Yeah.
I think that's just a sense I got, and it's not actually the case.
I think what it is it just like Jersey Shore, it is a very, very specific niche part that is a part of New Jersey. Like, if you go to Seaside, especially if you went to Seaside in, like, the mid-90s, you would see those people. That doesn't mean that everyone in New Jersey is like those people. There is a part of New Jersey that is Sopranos-esque. It's a very small part of a very populated mm-hmm. and complex place.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's more, maybe that's why it relates to that, to Jersey Shore in your head, because it's such a tiny subculture that is, like, has been made to represent the very, very populous state with lots of different types of people in it.
I have no notes. That sounds exactly right to me. I'll bet you're 100% correct.
Yeah, because, like, I knew people that were, like, Sopranos types, but not involved in the mob, but sounded like them, or, like, the sort of old Italian grandma's house with, like, plastic on the furniture. Like, I knew lots of people with those grandmas.
Some of, like, the two, I talked earlier in this episode about, like, becoming, like, a tertiary member of several families, and two of them are those families so... just I almost think that's why I bristle. I don't bristle at The Sopranos, but why I've been resistant, because I'm like, don't make a caricature of people I love. Like,
right.
And I worry that that's what it does.
Yeah.
We'll find out.
Yeah. No, I mean, I went to school with the same 22 kids from first to eighth grade, and they had names like Muscatello and Sakachi mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. like, you know, every freaking Italian last name you can come up with. So mm-hmm. I did kind of grow up with these people. Adjacent
right
to these people. So yeah, I'm excited. I think it'll be interesting. I do hope this isn't the episode where all of the people that have found us from New Jersey as a world decide they hate us and disappear because
no.
we love you, but this may not be the Sopranos episode you're wanting.
but also maybe not. Who
yeah.
knows?
True.
I have a feeling I'm gonna love it. I really do. I think I'm gonna really like it. Did you see how I walked that back? I think I'm going to love it. I really think I'm going to like it. I think of it, I'm going to be pleasantly surprised. I think it's going to be okay. I think it's probably going to be fine. Yeah.
It's not going to be torture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
I did. I mean, it's notoriously a very well-made show.
Right. Exactly.
With a very controversial ending, mm-hmm. which we're not really going to focus on. But
no. Which, again, is one of those things that I read the Wikipedia for. So.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well. That is next week. We have at least, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We have like 8 or 9 more that we're sure of.
Mm-hmm.
So if any of our listeners have suggestions, we're still taking them. But we got you covered for the next couple months for sure.
And then we'll reassess and we'll decide if we're just going to live in pilot land.
Yeah.
Eventually, we'll pick Yellow Jackets back up at season one. We'll go right through season two. Oh, you said, I tricked you.
You scared me. I scared myself. We're not doing that. So anyway, Andrea, where can they find you?
I'm at AQAndreaQ on Instagram.
They can get in touch with us both through watcherspodnj@gmail.com or the Instagram account for us, which is watcherspodnj. And I am on Instagram at @Jodie_MIM, @Jodie_MIM.
I think that's everything.
That is. We will see you in fucking Jersey.
Hell yeah.
Going back home. Oh no. The soundboard is still there.
It's never leaving.
God. All right. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye. Oh God. I really just want to go back and watch this together.